Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the podcast, Little Eyes, Little Ears, Centering Children and Youth in Gender-Based Violence Work. This podcast is from the Learning Network at the Center for Research and Education on Violence Against Women and Children at Western University. The purpose of this podcast is to enhance work to support children and youth in contexts of intimate partner violence. I'm Dr. Linda Baker, and I'm pleased to host today's episode with our amazing guest, Maya Lebrun. Maya has been advocating for children's rights within the Canadian family justice system for the past 4 years, starting when she was only 16. She has had the privilege of speaking at provincial and Supreme Court judges' conferences, sharing at multiple continuing legal education conferences, representing BC in UNICEF's Child Safe Cities Summit, and having published in BARTalk. She just completed her term as a board member for Mediate BC and has signed on to the youth advisory team for a research project looking to reduce youth sexual violence. Maya is currently obtaining her bachelor's in law and works as a children's coordinator at her church. Maya, it's hard to imagine that somebody as young as you has done all of these things already. And we're so pleased to have you with us today. And I wonder if you'll just start by telling us a little more about yourself.
Hey, thank you for having me. A little bit more about me. I'm a sister. I have two younger sisters. I'm a daughter. I'm a cat mom. I do a lot of work with youth in the summers, especially working at camps. Beyond that, I'm a student and, you know, trying out online school and different things like that. So, yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Maya, one of the things that we're really interested in is we know that in terms of gender-based violence work, that there's a long tradition and commitment to valuing survivor voices. And we wanted to ask you, how can we make the inclusion of child and youth survivor voices in services and supports a reality? So to go beyond having it as a value or an aspiration, but really make it happen.
I think involving kids in what you're doing in your projects, I think there's two sides. So if you're asking about how do services for people, survivors of gender-based violence or kids, in the legal system, like how to service them and have them at the center is one thing. And then also how to just help the general public and just how to help kids in the legal system and how to help kids who are out of it and wanting to help frame the way that we do the legal system and in services. I think as far as reaching kids and having them be involved and getting that audience and also finding kids that want to be a part of your work, is just having greater advertising for it, I think is a big thing. I think having a social media presence is really important, and also going to places where kids are. So whether that's doing, you know, assemblies at schools, going into classes, putting posters up in schools, putting up in community centers, in sports team rec centers, going to coffee shops and restaurants that are right around high schools and putting up your materials. That's all places that kids are, and they're going to see things. They're not going to see things that are just, you know, not in their area or just in a courthouse, just in a government agency. Like, they're just not, they're not there. They don't see those. Even just a lot of the children's legal offices. Like, we have one in Vancouver, putting things up there. That's where kids will see them. So I think making sure that you're marketing to the right audience is really, really big for having kids want to come and know about it and partake. Having honorariums to just, yeah, honor their time and be a motivating factor for teens is a really big thing. Even just food, if you can't afford to do an honorarium, if you feed a kid, they will come. So, yeah.
Those are great ideas. It's interesting because I think you're right. A lot of times, the services that may be really wanting to involve youth, children and youth, they may do it through their typical portals, so to speak. So they may do it in terms of their own website or put a call out on that. But children and youth may not be accessing or even know about that website.
No, and honestly, like if you're gonna do that, that's fine, but make yourself really easily like Googleable, searchable. Make yourself really easy to find. So if a kid, I know from, like if a kid's going, I don't know, for if they want a children's lawyer, Child Lawyer Vancouver, like be so easy to find that they can find you. And then also just making yourself available to kids in remote communities that maybe don't have a t like complete internet access or just different things. Because I think those kids get left out a lot, and they're really important in having a voice and being part of the change that's happening.
And do you have specific ideas for how we make sure that youth that are in more remote areas aren't left out from opportunities like this?
Well, I've heard about from my profs different research projects they did, and surveying had to look very different than just an online survey that they can send to most urban kids. I think it would look like sending someone from your team into one of these communities and physically being there and going, "This is an opportunity. How can I set you up? What materials do you need, resources to share to be a part of this?" And set that up in that community, set that up with those kids, and then you're going to have an ongoing relationship. Whether it is a letter-based system, then, well, okay, then if it's okay, maybe we can get you a computer or maybe we can set up Wi-Fi in your house, like whatever it is to go, okay, I want to make sure that your voice gets to be a part of this and that your community gets to be a part of this. So that's not just one, urban kids are amazing. I'm an urban kid, but making sure that everybody's a part of it,
I was also interested in, as you were describing this, do you have any suggestions or insights on, it's one thing to reach young people and they know that there's an opportunity to have a voice and to participate, but how should we go about making sure that that's meaningful, that it's not just a taking from youth, but that it's a two-way. They're benefiting from the experience. And obviously, the program or the project, the service is also benefiting from their input.
Well, I think on our side of it, we're pretty simple. It's really nice to get paid and to show that our time was valued. And that will, that just shows that, okay. I mean, the people that are doing it are getting paid to be there. And so we're also honoring the youth and that, okay, they're getting paid an honorarium. What you're sharing matters. I think sending them materials of what their contribution did or what it contributed to is really important. So follow up. Being understanding of their schedules is really great. And understanding, okay, you go to school from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. How can we make this accessible to you as well and not, kind of think outside of just our 9 to 5 realm?
Right.
I
Those
think
are good.
just making sure that the staff that are working with the kids are one train are trauma informed. Because if you're asking survivors, then they're going to have a lot of, triggers and different things that just need maybe extra support. But also just having someone that's used to working with kids is important because I think there's a lot of incredible people in the system that want to do great work, but maybe don't know how to relate to kids. And that can be really hard and create a barrier, especially for, younger teens or younger kids that want to share, but aren't given the right support. I think a lot of kids that go through the family justice system are already parentified. So maybe requiring them just continue to be the adult, make sure that their needs are being met. Like we can all do that, but it'd be nice, if there were just enough support to do it too.
I'm really glad that you gave an example of a barrier. And I think there's probably other barriers that can really get in the way. And what kind of barriers, other than people maybe not feeling comfortable or knowing how to engage youth or how to interact with youth in a supportive way, What other kinds of barriers do you see in terms of barriers to children and youth having a voice in a meaningful way?
If I've done anything in the last 4 years, it's go to a lot of meetings, and those are great and super effective. And I think I've seen them done really well and really progress over the past 4 years. So I think what I've seen is, at first I feel like I was one of the very few youth that would be in a group, and now it's, becoming, I mean, I'm going to a conference in 2 weeks. And I think, like, I don't know if it's like 64 or 70 of the participants are kids and youth and
Wow.
survivors. So before it was like one to two of us, and now it's 60 to 70. So, making space, really making space at your table for a youth. And, you don't have to invite any kid. Like, that's what, like, we're not asking just any person who maybe has no thoughts on something to come. But if you find a youth or a child that has something to say and can meaningfully participate and contribute, making sure that there's a spot for them. I know one issue that was happening pre like a few years ago in some meetings I was in, where the youth that were there were would, by no one's fault, just become the designated note takers for what was going on, and that just wasn't very good. And no one had ill intention. It would just be, okay, we're doing this over Zoom or something, or with Menti, and the youth would know how to run it maybe a little bit better than some of the other participants, but then they would just be like the note takers, apart from being, just not being able to participate as much because of that. So I think making sure that it's very clear that the kids are not there to take notes or to be tech support, but to participate,
Exactly. It really brings meaning to what we mean by child and youth survivor voices. And it's not being an extra pair of hands at an event, is what you're
Great.
saying. And that's, but you've seen some progress in that area,
For
that
sure.
there's less of that that's happening now.
Yeah,
And
definitely.
Maya, do you think that's in part because of feedback
Yeah.
from it's
Yeah. So
the
I do a lot of work with youth voices. And how, and I mean, that's where I really started and have branched off in a lot of different directions from that. But one thing that I really value is after, say, a conference, there'll be a meeting and just going over, what went well, what didn't go well, and then having the coordinator, I don't know if you know Carrie Boyle, but she coordinates that, her then going to whatever conference that we spoke at and just making sure that they know our feedback and our, reshaping and redoing. And it's like definitely in a not a condemnation way of like, oh my gosh, you wrecked these kids' lives. Like, no, it's all good. It's just fine-tuning different parts of everybody wanting to do a good thing and just how to do it the best.
Right. So it really is like anything else. There's a learning process to it. And you're
100%.
doing work, it sounds like, Maya, to make sure it's not just an event, that it is a process, and that we're all building capacity in terms of how to better support youth voices in our events and in projects, and that feedback becomes critical for that.
Yeah, honestly, I feel like I don't know how much I've done in that sphere of being able to shape the culture of it, but I think the leaders that I've seen do it, that I've gotten to work with, like Carrie Boyle, Jane Morley, and everything she does, and the Society for Children and Youth of BC, are like two people in one group that just really have been, I don't know, pioneering a lot of this, I think, in really how to build a really safe, an inclusive area for kids to participate in the legal system, in the transforming of the legal system. Yeah.
You mentioned that you would hope that people that were supporting children and youth, that they used a trauma-informed approach. And whether that's within the justice system, whether that's at a conference that's being held, whatever, wherever, and whatever is being done. Are there other approaches or things that you would want people to consider? You've mentioned some really important ones, honoring people's time, and wherever possible, that being an honorarium, food, supports, being inclusive, finding ways to make it work with a young person's schedule, where they live, if there's difficulties accessing the internet, etc. Are there other things in terms of really supporting child and youth voices that people could do?
I feel like I've hit a lot of it around the services. I think we're moving away from tokenism and just having your token kid that's their like your poster child. I think that's fine, but as long as it doesn't just stay there, you know, where it's moving into participation, not just this is. And I've seen this, you know, with different youth I've talked with, of you know wanting to move away from this is their story. Please feel bad for them, and then that be it. But going on, this is their story. What can we draw from this? How can we work with this youth if they want to create change, to advise change, to, you know, be a part of the process. So it's not just we heard from you once, thank you so much, and then moving on and not changing their practice. But I fully believe in storytelling. I think it's a really beautiful way that you can create a lot of change. I just think pairing that with action with the youth is also really important. Just a lot of inclusivity, a lot of going to where these kids are, including them. And you don't ha again, you don't have to take just every teenager off like that you find, but if you see someone, you're like, I want to champion you and I want to get behind you and help, you know, if I want to see what your vision for my service is. I want, if they have an experience with it, you know, and I feel like I've had a lot of beautiful people in my life do that for me, and it's led to a lot of amazing things. So, I mean, being in this podcast is the product of a lot of people in my life championing me, whether it's just people that work in the service side of this, whether it's my stepmom, who's been a huge support, my sisters, my parents, but I think support can do a lot of crazy things.
I think that sometimes you talk about the importance of telling one's story, but you also talk about the importance of going beyond that. And I guess one of the tensions that I think exists in the field is balancing concerns about re-harming or re-traumatizing a child or a youth who's sharing their story of survival while respecting their agency and rights. And so it can really become... it's almost the tension between wanting to protect and recognizing agency and respecting agency. Could you speak to that?
I think if a kid wants to talk to you and wants to be a part of what you're doing, then they know what their capacity is. If someone doesn't want to, then they won't, as long as we're not being forced by like a parent. But if they're making the choice to, you know, it's pretty obvious to tell if it's their choice or if they're being forced, then I think they know the risk, and there's not really a huge risk. I think sometimes when you, once you're going as a kid going, you know, through starting to be a part of the change, then you can just be like, okay, well, you know, sharing my story that way felt good. Maybe that was actually too much information that was a little hard on myself. I think if a youth or a kid is wanting to take part in this, in your service and in helping shape and change and share their story, then they know going into that what's going to be required of them, and they can make an informed decision. I think making sure that they have supports in place for them and just checking in, and also just letting them know, like, hey, you're going to share your, if they're young, just, hey, you're going to share your story. It may make some feelings come up for you later. Here are some supports for you. Please make sure that you take care of yourself, that you're not like sharing and then going right straight to school after, but just reminding them or reminding their parents or whatever of, you know, please take care of yourself after this. Like what you just did was really important and also could bring out some things for you. But beyond that, I think as long as you're making clear what your expectations are, then a kid knows this is something I want to do, this is something I don't want to do, and they can make an informed decision. I mean, honestly, with the way that we're doing this right now is quite transferable that anyone could take. You didn't ask me to share my story. I'd be happy to if you wanted me to, but that's just not really what this is. And so you're just asking me questions. I'm giving you feedback. And nothing about this would ever be traumatizing, at least for me.
I think that we have begun to do a better job of bringing supports on the day of. But I really don't want to lose your point about it may be later that the impact of having shared that story, that it's great that there's supports there and that there's sort of a wraparound child or youth if they are open to that the day of. But you were talking about the follow-up. And do people, would you advise people to help ensure that the youth has a support system? Should there be, or is there an onus on the host or the coordinator to do that check-in and follow-up if it's agreed to ahead, if the youth is open to that?
If it's something that you want to bring up beforehand of like, hey, would this be helpful to you? And then they get to decide on the just I think each individual kid's going to be different. For me personally, I don't think I need someone to check in with me after to make sure that I'm mentally okay because I am and I will be. But maybe for some kids that's going to be really helpful. And just making sure that kids are safe. So yeah, I think giving them the option. Yeah, I think also encouraging your youth and your kids after they've done something with you to share, to be a part of something, making sure that they know that, thank you, like that's thank you for doing this. It meant a lot. Having feedback, if anybody sends in feedback of, if it's at a conference, then sharing what was in the chat afterwards is so encouraging for youth and encouraging for kids and wanting them to do more of it. Yeah. I think that would be my only thought on it.
When you think about youth rights, children and youth rights, it was, I think, in 1989 that the UN Convention on the Rights of Children was penned. Where have we come with that? And maybe start with the legal system because you've been so involved. I mean, I think that we at some points were almost actively trying to keep children out of the system. We were thinking and out of we thought we were doing the right thing. I think there was a good intent, but we've learned that that wasn't. And in fact, that's denying rights. And what progress has been made, do you think? What differences, even in your time span, have you seen? And that would be really helpful.
I think children's rights have greatly progressed since then. That is such an incredible piece of legal text that we have or legislature. But well, I mean, we have children's lawyers now, and we have them in a solicitor client model, which is so important.
Why is
Because
that
actually,
important, Maya? Why is that so important that it's the solicitor client model?
Okay, well, there's different models to having a children's lawyer. This one, solicitor client, basically, it's the same as if you went to a lawyer, your relationship with your lawyer and the way that you direct them would be the exact same as how, but with a child. So the lawyer isn't making decisions for the child. It is not, they are not choosing, this is what's best for you, and I'm going to advocate for that, which, that could be helpful if you're, if the child is very young, like three, two, three, four, one. And if there's parents that, just really can't, it's just having a watchdog, basically, to make sure that the kids' needs are being put first. But once a kid is, able to make decisions and direct a lawyer, and the lawyer's offices gauge that with each kid to make sure that they can, delegate and give direction, then I think it's important that that they have this model because I think it could be more dangerous if, say, a 15-year-old is having someone else again continue to put their narrative on their story and be presenting that to a judge and that having so much weight. Yeah, I mean, that's why I think it's important. I think it's important that kids have the ability to share what's going on in their lives from them and have the judge have direct access to the kids, not through just a psychology report, not just a social worker's summary of what happened in their life and if it's valid or not, but this is what's going on in the kid's life from like high conflict to low conflict. I think it's important. Other ways that, I mean, there's so many changes. I mean, in the way that we involve youth in the change that's going on has changed in the last at least 4 years. And it was, it started way before me and before this 4 year thing. So seeing that be a part of it, having a greater emphasis in general of supporting youth, supporting children's rights, making that an actual big deal, that kids, moving from a place of kids being property to kids being their own person, their own experience, their life matters. I mean, in general, we've just come a long way in rights and valuing humans of all shapes and sizes and forms and whatever. So, yeah.
It's been transformational, but I also am hearing from you there's it's great the progress that's been made, but we still got a ways to go.
Yeah,
And
I think in I mean, for me, I think the big ways that things we need to change is especially how we interview children, how we like within the system itself, how we protect kids, I think is very messy and where there's a lot of issues for the most part.
can you talk a little bit more about that? How we protect kids? Are you talking in terms of child protection services in that sense, or just generally our desire to protect kids and how that can go amiss?
There are so many parts to that. I mean, a buzz one that's going on right now is how do we protect kids online? Because we're seeing the repercussions of, I mean, the internet is not an evil place, but there's a lot of dark spots on it that kids sadly get exposed to and causes a lot of pain and causes a lot of issues. And so how to protect them on there is a really big question that I think people are trying to grapple with. I think in the legal system itself, the way that we interview children, I think is very problematic and not safe. I don't have the solution right now of what we could, of how to fully make a new way to do that, but I think that the way that, having MCFD come in, like MCFD is great. They do a lot of great things. Of course, there are critiques of ways that they do things. I don't have the answer, but I think especially in how maybe they go to people's houses where the abuser is and then interview the child, even if the parent's out of the house, like it just is not safe. Or really promoting the kid wanting to share, tell the truth. I think too, yes, neither parent knows what the kid says right away. But when a report comes out, we don't have very many safeguards for the kid once the parents. The abusive parent knows what was shared. The kid's just left with that. I think there's a lot of danger in that, and I know I've seen that in my own family story. I mean, not all kids get access to a lawyer because it's not a right that every kid has. So, I think I would love to see a change in our laws around that, where it's not just, okay, well, if you have the worst situation, then you can have a lawyer or if the judge says it's okay, because I think that leaves a lot of kids out.
Or
But
if you
yeah.
just happen to be in a jurisdiction where they're available and some jurisdictions
Exactly.
not,
Yeah.
regardless of what's going on in that child's life.
I think too, like really, I'm not an advocate for reunification camps, and forced reunification therapy. I think those are very detrimental and, so backwards. I understand the heart in it is, wanting to reunite families, but I just don't know if that's always, I don't know if we should always look from a place of, well, we need to have this family that where the mom and the dad are together and they're with their kids. But it's like, if you wouldn't trust your own kids with that person, why are we trying to force a kid to be with them? If the judge or whoever wouldn't want their grandkid or their child to be with that person, why are we forcing another kid to do that? So I just don't think that always, I definitely think having family is important, but I don't think, forcing kids to be with someone that they really don't want to be with, I'm sure they have a good reason. I understand there's, ebbs and flows to that and difference, but, and I know a lot behind reunification is the alienation trump card that that is, definitely being discussed in the world right now, which I'm really glad is that a lot of that is coming down, because I think I've seen a lot of pain come out of reunification and also out of Using the alienation card that if a kid has a voice and doesn't want to do what one parent is saying, then well, they've been alienated. I just don't think that, adds up.
No,
Yeah.
no. If you had a crystal ball and a magic wand, where do you want to see us with respect to children's rights and in child and youth survivor voices in 20 years' time?
Think for our services, I would love to see the work that's being done just continue in including kids and even just in all sides of government and all sides of the work world. Having youth and kids be a part of what we're building in society, I think, is really important, and doing that in a really safe way. But having them be a part of things and starting them on the process of creating change young, I think it could be a really cool thing. I think a lot of change within the legal system, having more social workers, which, that's a hard process in itself, but having more social workers and social workers that, are trained and understand how to identify covert abuse and coercive control. I think that's really important. I would love to see suicide rates drop, which I think everybody does, but I think that that also comes through systems. That comes, that actually takes work being put into it. I think having kids be rescued and seen within the system, being a normal in 20 years would be beautiful. I just don't think that's a reputation our system has right now. And I think having more transitional supports for kids coming out of care and foster care into adulthood would be major, and kind of stopping the pipeline from aging out to youth homelessness. I think we would solve a lot of issues if we could have more supports and help heal, a lot of the toxicity in our system. So those are really, really broad, but I think practical things, having more children's lawyers all over Canada, all over the world, but if we're not in Canada, in remote communities, I think better training all around for parents, for teachers, coaches, service workers, social workers on how to identify covert abuse and coercive control. Yeah, no more reunification therapy, and also no more having police remove children from the home they want to stay in because of a court order. If not, they're being abused, please take them out. But taking them out of a home where they feel safe just because of the court order, I think all of that is a major issue, and I would love for that not to be happening anymore in the future.
Maya, your dreams are inspirational. I hope I'm around in 20 years to see how much progress we've made. But I know that just listening to a little bit about your studies, that you're going to continue your work in this area and that our Canadian context and the world's going to be a better place because of it. So, thank you so much for spending this time with us and for talking so openly and off the cuff. It's really going to resonate with, I think, many, many people that are also working to bring about change and maybe, inspire some who haven't spent as much time thinking about some of these things when it comes to children and youth as you have in these last years. With that, I'd like
Thank
to just,
you.
you're welcome.
I'm just so happy to be here. Thank you for having me and spending this time talking with me. And I don't know, this is so good. I'm really excited.
Oh, that's wonderful. I want to just remind our audience to stay tuned for the next episode in this podcast series. And how you'll learn about that is from the Learning Network. So watch for an email that will let you know when the next episode is ready. And again, Maya, thank you. Take care. Bye.